Chapter 10. Mr. Ozakawa could find his way in the dark. Some nights he closed his eyes rather than strain them trying to see. He knew the schedule and habits of every guard, where they walked and when they slept. He knew who made their bed on the floor and how to step over them carefully. He felt the corners of walls with his fingertips, avoided boards that creaked, could turn a doorknob as silently as a leaf falls. He was so proficient at moving through the house that he thought that even if he had no place to go, he might be tempted to get up and stretch his legs, go from room to room just because he could. It even occurred to him that he might be able to escape now if he wanted to, simply walk down the front path to the gate at night and set himself free. He did not want to. Everything he knew he learned from Carmen, who taught him without benefit of a translator. To teach someone how to be perfectly quiet, you don't need to speak to them. Everything Mr. Hosokawa needed desperately to know, Carmen taught him over 2 days. He still carried around his notebook, added 10 new vocabulary words to his list every morning, but he still struggled against the tide of memorization. For silence, though, he had a gift. He could tell from the approval in Carmen's eyes, from the light touch of her fingers on the back of his hand. She taught him how to get from place to place in the house in plain sight of everyone, and yet no one saw them because she was teaching him to be invisible. It was learning humility, to no longer assume that anyone would notice who you were or where you were going. It wasn't until she began to teach him that Mr. Hosokawa saw Carmen's genius, because her genius was to not be seen. How much harder that would be for a beautiful young girl in a house full of restless men. And yet he found that she drew almost no attention at all. She managed to pass as a boy, and more impressively had managed to make herself utterly forgettable after she had been revealed as a beautiful girl. When Carmen walked through the room without wanting to be seen, she hardly moved the air around her. She didn't sneak. She did not dart to hide behind the piano and then a chair. She walked through the middle of the room, asking for nothing, keeping her head level, making no sound. In fact, she had been teaching him this lesson since the day they were first in the house together, but it was only now that he could understand it. She would have accompanied him upstairs every night, she told that again, but it was better that he know how to go on his own. Nothing made people as clumsy as fear, and she could show him how not to be afraid.
"She's an extraordinary girl,"
Mr. Hosokawa said again.
"She seems to be," Gen said.
Mr. Hosokawa gave him a small, avuncular smile and pretended that there was nothing else to say. That was part of it, too, the private life. Mr. Hosokawa had a private life now. He had always thought of himself as a private man, but now he saw that there was nothing in his life before that had been private. It didn't mean that he had no secrets then, and now he did. It was that now there was something that was strictly between himself and one other person, that it was so completely their own that it would have been pointless to even try to speak of it to someone else. He wondered now if everyone had a private life. He wondered if his wife had one. It was possible that all those years he had been alone, never knowing that a complete world existed and no one spoke of it. During their entire captivity, he had slept through the night, but now he knew how to sleep and how to wake up in the pitch-black darkness without the aid of a clock. Often when he woke up, Gen was gone. Then he would stand and walk so peacefully, so above suspicion, that if someone were to wake and see him, they would have only thought he was going to get a drink of water. He stepped over his neighbors, his compatriots, and made his way to the back stairs behind the kitchen. Once he saw a light on beneath a closet door and thought he heard whispering, but he didn't stop to see what it might be. It didn't concern him, which was part of being invisible. He floated up the back steps. He had never been so easy inside his own skin. He thought at once he had never been so alive and so much a ghost. It would have been fine if he were to climb these steps forever, always the lover going to meet his beloved. He was happy then. And every step he climbed, he was happier. He wished he could stop time. As much as Mr. Hosokawa was overwhelmed by love, he could never completely shake what he knew to be the truth. That every night they were together could be seen as a miracle for 100 different reasons. Not the least of which was that at some point these days would end. Would be ended for them.
He tried not to give himself over to fantasies. He would get a divorce, he would follow her from city to city, sitting in the front row of every opera house in the world. Happily he would have done this, given up everything for her. But he understood that these were extraordinary times, and if their old life was ever restored to them, nothing would be the same. When he opened the door to her room, there were tears in his eyes more often than not, and he was grateful for the darkness. He didn't want her to think that anything had gone wrong. She came to him, and he pressed his damp face into the fall of lemon-scented hair. He was in love, and never had he felt such kindness toward another person. Never had he received such kindness. Maybe the private life wasn't forever. Maybe everyone got it for a little while and then spent the rest of their lives remembering. In the china closet, Carmen and Gen made a decision. 2 full hours of studying before they made love. Carmen was still every bit as serious about learning to read and write Spanish. Look at all the progress she'd made. Haltingly, she could read an entire paragraph without asking for help. She was completely committed to learning English. She could fully conjugate 10 verbs and knew at least 100 nouns and other parts of speech. She held out hopes for Japanese so she could speak to Gen in his own language when all of this was over, and they would be in bed together at night. Gen was equally firm on their resolve to continue Carmen's lessons. It would be pointless to have come so far and then just abandon everything because they were in love. Wasn't this exactly what love was, to want what was best for someone? To help them along as Carmen and Gen helped each other? No, they would study and practice for 2 hours, no less than they had done before. After that, yes, their time was their own and they could do whatever they wanted. Carmen stole the egg timer from the kitchen. They settled into work. Spanish first. Carmen had found a satchel of school books stuffed in the closet of the vice president's daughter. Skinny books with pictures of rolling puppies on the front. A fatter book of paper with solid lines and dotted lines to practice penmanship. The girl had only used 5 pages. She had written the alphabet and her numbers. She had written her name, Imelda Iglesias, over and over again in sweetly curved letters. Carmen wrote her name beneath that. She wrote out the words Gen told her. Pescado, calcetín, sopa, fish, sock, soup. All he wanted was to press his lips against the side of her neck. He would not stop the lesson. She was leaning over her notebook, working so hard to make her letters as nice as those of the vice president's 8-year-old daughter. 2 thick strands of hair fell forward onto the notebook. Carmen ignored them and folded her lower lip into her mouth to concentrate. He wondered if it was possible to die from wanting someone so much. In this narrow hall of plates, all he could smell was her, lemons, and the dusty, sun-bleached smell of her uniform, the softer, more complicated smell of Carmen's skin. 30 seconds to kiss her neck, that wasn't asking so much. He would not even mind if she kept on writing. He would kiss her that gently. Her pencil need never leave the page. When she looked up, his face was very close to hers, and she could no longer remember the word he said. And if he was to say it again, she would not know how to spell it, or how to bend a single letter out of a straight line. All she needed was a kiss, a single kiss to clear her head, and then she would be all business again, right back to work. She could not make herself swallow or blink. She was sure that with one kiss she could study all night. It would not make her less of a student. She had no mind for letters anyway. All she could think of was the grass and trees and dark night sky, the smell of the jasmine the first time he slid her shirt over her head and fell to his knees to kiss her stomach, her breasts. "Pastel," Gen said, his voice unsteady. Perhaps she was trained in ways she didn't understand, like a police dog, and cake was the word that released her, because as soon as he said it, she fell on him, book and pencil skittering across the floor. She ate off of him, huge devouring gulps, pressed her tongue against his tongue, rolled against the lower cupboards where soup bowls were stacked, one nestled perfectly inside the other. They did not go back to work that night. So the next night they agreed, an hour of studying before giving in. They applied themselves with great seriousness, but in fact that plan was 3 minutes less successful than the one they'd had the night before. They were hopeless, starving, reckless, and everything they did again. They experimented with shorter lengths of time, but in every attempt they were unsuccessful, until Gen came up with the following plan. They would make love immediately, the second they had securely closed the door behind them. And then after that, they would study. And it was this plan that was by far the most successful. Sometimes they fell asleep for a while, Carmen curled against Gen's chest, Gen inside the crook of Carmen's arm. Like soldiers shot in battle, they lay where they fell. Other times they had to make love again, the first time forgotten as soon as it was finished. But for the most part, they managed to get some work done. Before it was anywhere near getting light, they would kiss goodnight, and Carmen would go back to sleep in the hallway in front of Roxanne's door, and Gen would go back to the floor next to Mr. Hosokawa's couch. Sometimes they detected the slightest sound of his movement as he came down the stairs. Sometimes Carmen passed him in the hall. Did the others know? Possibly, but they wouldn't have said anything. They suspected only Roxanne Koss and Mr. Hosokawa, who did not hesitate to hold hands or exchange a brief kiss during the day. If anyone suspected Gen and Carmen of anything, it was only that perhaps they helped the first couple in their meetings. Roxanne Koss and Mr. Hosokawa, however improbable to those around them, were members of the same tribe, the tribe of the hostages. So many people were in love with her that, of course, it was only natural that she should fall in love with one of them. But Gen and Carmen were another matter. Even if the generals relied on Gen's translations and polished secretarial skills, even if they found him extremely bright and pleasant enough, they never forgot who he was. And even though the hostages had a soft spot for Carmen, the way she kept her eyes down, her unwillingness to point her gun at anyone directly, when there was any call from the generals, she went and stood with them. Recently, life had improved for all the hostages, not just those who were in love. Once the front door had been opened, it opened regularly. Every day, they went outside and stood in the hot sun. Lothar Falken encouraged other men to take up running. He led them through a series of exercises every day, and then they went in a pack around and around the house. The soldiers played soccer with a ball they had found in the basement, and some days there was an actual game, the terrorists against the hostages, though the terrorists were so much younger and trained into better shape that they almost always won. When Messner came now, he often found everyone in the yard. The priest got up from his digging and waved. "How is the world?" Father Argueta said to him.
"Impatient,"
Messner said. His Spanish kept improving, but still he asked for Gen. Father Argueta pointed to the sprawled-out figure beneath a tree.
"Sleeping. It is a terrible thing the way they work him so hard. And you, they work you too hard as well. If you don't mind my saying, you look tired."
It was true that recently Messner had lost the sang-froid that everyone had found so reassuring in the beginning. He had aged 10 years in the 4.5 months they had been living here, and while everyone else seemed to mind it less and less, Messner clearly minded it more.
"All this sunlight is no good for me," Messner said. "All Swiss citizens were meant to live in the shade."
"It's very warm," the priest said, "but the plants do wonderfully. Rain, sun, drought, there's no holding them back."
"I won't keep you from your work."
Messner patted the priest on the shoulder, remembering how they had tried several times to let him go and how the priest would have none of it. He wondered if in the end Father Arguedas would be sorry to have stayed. Probably not. Regret didn't seem to be in his nature the way it was in Messner's. Paco and Renato ran up from the side lawn, which they now called the playing field, and made an extremely half-hearted effort to frisk him that consisted of nothing more than a few brisk slaps near his pockets. Then they ran back to join the game, which had been stopped for this purpose.
"Gen," Messner said, and tapped the sleeping body on the shoulder with the toe of his shoe. "For God's sake, get up."
Gen was sleeping the sleep of the heavily drugged. His mouth was open and slack, and his arms flung straight out to the side. A small rippling snore came up from his throat.
"Hey, translator!"
He leaned over and picked up one of Gen's eyelids between his thumb and forefinger. Gen shook him off and opened his eyes slowly.
"You speak Spanish," Gen said thickly. "You have from the beginning. Now leave me alone."
He rolled over on his side and pulled his knees up to his chest.
"I don't speak Spanish. I don't speak anything. Get up." Messner thought he felt a shaking in the earth. Surely Gen must feel it, lying with his cheek pressed down to the grass. Was it his imagination that the earth might actually cave in beneath them? How much did these engineers know? Who's to say that the ground wouldn't swallow them up, opera diva and common criminal in the same fatal bite? Messner got down on his knees. He pressed his palms to the grass, and when he had decided that he was only experiencing a temporary madness, he shook Gen again.
"Listen to me," he said in French. "We have to talk them into surrendering. Today. This can't go on, do you understand me?"
Gen rolled onto his back, stretched like a cat, and then folded his arms beneath his head. "And then we'll talk the trees into growing blue feathers." "Haven't you paid attention at all, Messner? They aren't going to be talked into anything, especially not by the likes of us." The likes of us. Messner wondered if Gen was implying that he had not done his job well enough. 4.5 months, living in a hotel room half the world away from Geneva, when all he had come here for in the first place was a holiday. Both parties were intractable, and what the party inside this wall didn't understand was that the government was always intractable. No matter what the country, what the circumstances. The government did not give in, and when they said they were giving in, they were lying. Every time you could count on it. As Messner saw it, it was his job not to hammer out a compromise, but merely to steer them clear of a tragedy. There wasn't much time left for this work. Despite the rhythmic thud of the runners and the boys playing soccer, he could definitely feel something happening in the ground. The sign of the Red Cross, like the very sign of Switzerland, stood for peaceful neutrality. Messner had stopped wearing his armband a long time ago, but he didn't believe in it any less. Members of the Red Cross brought food and medicine. Sometimes they would ferry papers for arbitration, but they were not moles. They did not spy. Joachim Messner would have no more told the terrorists what the military had planned than he would tell the military what was happening on the other side of the wall. "Get up," he said again. Sluggishly, Gen got up and raised an arm to Messner to be pulled to his feet. Was this a picnic? Had they been drinking so early? No one seemed to be suffering in the least. In fact, they all looked pink-cheeked and energetic. "The generals are probably still over at the playing field," Gen said. "They might be in the game."
"You have to help me," Messner said.
Gen pushed his hair back into some semblance of order with his fingers, and then finally awake, threw his arm across his friend's shoulder. "When have I not helped you?" The generals were not playing ball, but they were sitting at the edge of the field in 3 wrought iron chairs pulled over from the patio. General Alfredo was shouting instructions at the players, General Hector was watching with intense silence, and General Benjamin had his face tilted up to make an even plane for the sun. All 3 had their feet buried in the high grass. Gilbert kicked a beautiful shot, and Gen waited until the play was over to announce their guest.
"Sir," he said, meaning whoever looked up, "Messner is here."
"Another day," General Hector said.
The second arm of his glasses had broken off that morning, and now he held them up to his face like a pince-nez.
"I need to speak to you," Messner said.
If his voice had taken on some new urgency, none of them heard it over the whooping and shouting of the boys in the game.
"Permission to speak?" General Hector said.
General Alfredo hadn't taken his eyes off the game, and General Benjamin hadn't opened his eyes at all.
"I need to speak to you inside. We need to talk about negotiations."
Then General Alfredo turned his head in Messner's direction.
"They are ready to negotiate. Your negotiations."
General Hector waved his hand at Messner as if he had never been so bored in all his life.
"You're taking up our time."
He turned his attention back to the game and called out,
"Francisco, the ball!"
"Listen to me with seriousness," Messner said quietly in French. "One time. I have done a great deal for you. I have brought in your food, your cigarettes. I have carried your messages. I am asking that you sit down with me now and talk."
Even in the bright sun, Messner's face was drained of color. Gen looked at him, and then he translated the message, trying to keep Messner's tone of voice. The 2 of them stood there, but the generals did not look up again. Usually this was Messner's sign to go, but he stood there with his arms folded across his chest and waited.
"Enough,"
Gen whispered in English, but Messner didn't look at him. They waited for more than half an hour.
Finally, General Benjamin opened his eyes.
All right, he said, his voice as tired as Messner's. We'll go to my office.
Cesar, who had been so fearless when he sang from Tosca in front of the full house, really did prefer to practice in the afternoons when everyone else was outside, especially since practicing so often meant scales, which he found degrading. And he and Roxanne Koss were never alone. There was no such thing as alone. Kato was there to play the piano, and Mr. Ozakawa was there because he was always there. Today, Ishmael, who was regularly humiliated in soccer, had set up the chess set on a low table near the piano and played with Mr. Ozakawa. He and Cesar both had guns because if they both chose to stay in the house, then they were the default house guards. If Cesar complained about other people staying to listen, and if there was someone there to translate from Spanish to English and back into Spanish again, and several people could do this, Roxanne Koss would tell him that singing was intended to be heard by other people, and he might as well get used to it. He wanted to learn songs, arias, entire operas, but mostly she made him sing scales and nonsense lines. She made him roar and pucker his lips and hold his breath until he had to sit down quickly and put his head between his knees. It would have invited everyone in if she had let him sing a song with the piano, but that, she said, was something to be earned.
There's a boy who sings now? Messner asked. Is that Cesar?
He stopped in the living room to listen, and General Benjamin and Gen stopped with him. Cesar's jacket was too short in the sleeves and his wrists hung out like broomsticks with hands loosely attached. General Benjamin was clearly proud of the boy.
He's been singing for weeks now. You simply come at the wrong time. Cesar is always singing. Señorita Koss says he has the potential to be truly great as she is great.
Remember your breath? Roxanne said, and inhaled deeply to show Cesar what she meant. Cesar stumbled over a note, suddenly nervous to see the general there.
Ask her how he's doing, Benjamin said again.
Roxanne put her hand on Kato's shoulder, and he lifted his fingers from the keys as if she had touched an off switch. Cesar sang three more notes and then stopped when he realized the music was gone.
We've only been at this a very short time, but I think he has enormous potential.
Have him sing his song for Messner, General Benjamin said. Messner is in need of a song today.
Roxanne Koss agreed.
Listen to this, she said. We've been working on this.
She sang a few words under her breath so that Cesar knew what he was to sing. He could not read or write in Spanish, and certainly he didn't understand Italian, but his ability to memorize and repeat a sound, to repeat it with such pathos the listener could only imagine he understood what he was saying completely, was uncanny. Once she had prompted Cesar, Kato began to play the opening of Bellini's Malinconia Ninfa Gentile, the first short song from Se Ariete. Gen recognized the music. He had heard it floating through the windows in the afternoons. The boy closed his eyes and then looked toward the ceiling. O melancholy, you graceful nymph, I devote my life to you. When he forgot a line, Roxanne Koss sang it in a surprising tenor voice. I asked the gods for hills and springs. They listened to me at last. Then Cesar repeated the line. It was not unlike watching a calf rise up for the first time on spindly legs, at the same time awkward and beautiful. With every step he learned the business of walking. With every note he sang with more assurance. It was a very short song, finished almost as soon as it was started. General Benjamin clapped and Messner whistled.
Don't praise him too much, Roxanne said. He'll be ruined.
Cesar, his face flushed from pride or lack of breath, bowed his head to them.
Well, you can't tell it from looking at him,
General Benjamin said as he walked down the back hallway to his office with Messner and Gen. It was true, the only thing more crooked than Cesar's teeth was Cesar's nose.
It makes you wonder, all the brilliant things we might have done with our lives if only we suspected we knew how. I know I will never sing, Messner said. I know that much as well.
General Benjamin flipped the light on in the room and the three men sat down.
I want to tell you that soon now they will not let me come here anymore,
Messner said. Gen was startled. Life without Messner?
You are losing your job, the general said.
The government feels that they've put enough effort into negotiations.
I have seen no effort at all. They have made us no reasonable offers.
I am telling you this as someone who likes you, Messner said. I will not pretend that we are friends, but I want what is best for everyone here. Give this up. Do it today. Walk outside where everyone can see you and surrender.
Messner knew this was not convincing, and still he had no idea how to make it so. In his confusion, he wandered back and forth between the languages he knew. German, which he had spoken as a boy at home, French, which he had spoken in school, English, which he had spoken for the 4 years he lived in Canada when he was a young man, and Spanish, which he knew better every day. Gen tried his best to keep up with the patchwork, but with every sentence he had to stop and think. It was Messner's inability to stay with one country that frightened Gen more than what he was saying. There was no time to concentrate on what he was saying.
What about our demands? Have you spoken to them in a similar way? Have you spoken to them as friends?
They will give up nothing, Messner said. There is no chance.
No matter how long you wait, you have to trust me on this.
Then we will kill the hostages.
No, you won't,
Messner said, rubbing his eyes with his fingers.
I said it the first time we met. You are reasonable men. Even if you did kill them, it wouldn't change the outcome. The government would be even less inclined to bargain with you then.
From down the long hallway in the living room, they could hear Roxanne sing a phrase and then Cesar repeat the phrase. They went over it again and again, and the repetition was beautiful. Benjamin listened to the music for a while, and then, as if he had heard a note that didn't agree with him, he struck the table they used for chess with his fist. Not that it mattered, the game was in the other room.
Why is it our responsibility to make every concession? Are we expected to give up, just because we have such a long history of giving things up? I am trying to free the men I know from prison. I am not trying to join them. It is not my intention to put my soldiers down in those caves. I would sooner see them dead and buried.
You might see them dead, Messner thought, but you won't have the chance to see them buried. He sighed. There was no such place as Switzerland. Truly, time had stopped. He had always been here, and he would always be here.
I'm afraid those are your two choices, he said. The meeting is over.
General Benjamin stood up. You could chart the course of this story on his skin, which was burning now. The shingles flared with every word he spoke and every word he listened to.
It cannot be over. We have to keep talking until we reach some agreement. That is imperative. I am begging you to think about this. Messner, what else do I do all day?
The general said, and then he left the room. Messner and Gen sat alone in the guest bedroom suite, where hostages were not allowed to sit without guards. They listened to the small French enamel clock strike the hour of noon.
I don't think I can stand this anymore,
Messner said, after several minutes had passed. Stand what? Gen knew that everything was getting better. And not just for him, people were happier. Look, they were outside right now. He could see them from the windows, running.
It is a standoff, Gen said. Maybe a permanent one. If they keep us here forever, we'll manage.
Are you insane? Messner said.
You were the brightest one here once, and now you're as crazy as the rest of them. What do you think, that they'll just keep the wall up and pretend this is a zoo? Bring in your food, charge money for tickets? See defenseless hostages and vicious terrorists live together in peaceful coexistence. It doesn't just go on, someone puts a stop to it. And there needs to be a decision as to who will be in charge of the stopping.
Do you think the military has plans?
Messner stared at him.
Just because you're in here doesn't mean the rest of the world just shut down.
So they will arrest them.
At best.
The generals?
All of them.
But all of them could not possibly include Carmen. It could not include Beatrice, or Ishmael, or Cesar. When Gen scanned the list, he couldn't think of one he would be willing to give up, even the bullies and the fools. He would marry Carmen. He would have Father Arguedas marry them, and it would be legal and binding so that when they came for them, he could say she was his wife. But that would only save one, albeit the most important one. For the others, he had no ideas. How had he come to want to save all of them, the people who followed him around with loaded guns?
How had he fallen in love with so many people?
What do we do? Gen said.
You can try to talk them into giving up, Messner said. But honestly, I'm not even sure what good it would do them.
All his life, Gen had worked to learn the deep rolling R in Italian, the clutter of vowels in Danish. As a child in Nagano, he sat in the kitchen on a high stool repeating his mother's American accent while she chopped vegetables for dinner. She had gone to school in Boston and spoke French as well as English. His father's father worked in China as a young man, and so his father spoke Chinese and had studied Russian in college. In his childhood, it seemed that language changed on the hour. And no one was better at keeping up than Gen. He and his sisters played with words instead of toys. He studied and read, printed nouns onto index cards, listened to language tapes on the subway. He did not stop. Even if he was a natural polyglot, he never relied solely on talent. He learned. Gen was born to learn. But these last months had turned him around, and now Gen saw there could be as much virtue in letting go of what you knew as there had ever been in gathering new information. He worked as hard at forgetting as he had ever worked to learn. He managed to forget that Carmen was a soldier in the terrorist organization that had kidnapped him. That was not an easy task. Every day he forced himself to practice until he was able to look at Carmen and only see the woman he loved. He forgot about future and past. He forgot about his country, his work, and what would become of him when all of this was over. He forgot that the way he lived now would ever be over. And Gen wasn't the only one. Carmen forgot, too. She did not remember her direct orders to form no emotional bonds to the hostages. When she found it was a struggle to let such important knowledge slip from her memory, the other soldiers helped her forget. Ishmael forgot because he wanted to be the other son of Ruben Iglesias and an employee of Oscar Mendoza. He could picture himself sharing a bedroom with Ruben's son Marco and being a helpful older brother to the boy. Cesar forgot because Roxanne Koss had said he could come with her to Milan and learn to sing. How easy it was to imagine himself on a stage with her, a rain of tender blossoms pouring down on their feet. The generals helped them to forget by turning a blind eye to all the affection and slackness that surrounded them. And they could do that because there was so much they were forgetting themselves. They had to forget that they had been the ones to recruit these young people from their families by promising them work and opportunity and a cause to fight for. They had to forget that the president of the country had neglected to attend the party from which they had so elaborately planned to kidnap him, and so they changed their plans and took everyone else hostage. Mostly, they had to forget that they had not come up with a way to leave. They had to think that one might present itself if they waited long enough. Why should they think about the future? No one else seemed to remember it. Father Arguedas refused to think about it. Everyone came to Sunday Mass. He performed the sacraments, communion, confession, even last rites. He had put the souls in this house in order, and that was the only thing that mattered. So why should he think about the future? The future never even occurred to Roxanne Koss. She had become so proficient at forgetting that she never considered the wife of her lover anymore. She was not concerned that he ran a corporation in Japan, or that they did not speak the same language. Even the ones who had no real reason to forget had done so. They lived their lives only for the hour that lay ahead of them. Lothar Falken thought only of running around the house. Viktor Fyodorov thought of nothing but playing cards with his friends and gossiping about their love for Roxanne Koss. Tetsuya Kato thought of his responsibilities as an accompanist and forgot about the rest. It was too much work to remember things you might not have again. And so one by one they opened up their hands and let them go. Except for Messner, whose job it was to remember. And Simon Thibault, who even in his sleep thought of nothing but his wife. So even though Gen understood that there was something real and dangerous waiting for them, he began to forget it almost as soon as Messner left the house that afternoon. He busied himself typing up fresh lists of demands for the generals, and when it got later, he helped serve dinner. He went to sleep that night and woke up at 2 a.m. to meet Carmen in the china closet, and he told her, but not with the urgency he had felt in the afternoon. It was the sense of urgency he had managed to forget. "What Messner was saying worried me," Gen said. Carmen was sitting in his lap, both of her legs to the left of him, both of her arms around his neck.
worried me. Shouldn't he have said something stronger than that?
And Carmen, who should have listened, who should have asked him questions for her own safety and the safety of the other soldiers, her friends, only kissed him. Because the important thing was to forget. It was their business, their job. That kiss was like a lake, deep and clear, and they swam into it, forgetting.
"We'll have to wait and see," Carmen said.
Should they do something, try to escape? There must be a way by now. Everyone was lax. Hardly anyone was watching anymore. Gen asked her, his hands up under her shirt, feeling her shoulder blades flex beneath his fingertips.
"We could think about escaping," she said.
But the military would catch her and torture her. That's what the generals told them in training, and under the pains of torture she would tell them something. She could not remember what it was that she shouldn't tell, but that would be the thing that would get everyone else killed. There were only two places in the world to go, inside and outside, and the question was, where were you safer? Inside this house, in this china closet, she had never felt so safe in all her life. Clearly, St. Rose of Lima lived inside this house. She was protected here. She was rewarded for her prayers with abundance. It was always better to stay with your saint. She kissed Gen's throat. All girls dreamed of being in love like this.
"So we'll talk about it," Gen said, but now her shirt was off and it stretched out like a carpet for them to lie on.
They closed the angle between their bodies and the floor.
"Let's talk about it,"
she said, sweetly shutting her eyes. As soon as Roxanne Koss fell in love again. The two experiences were completely different, and yet coming as they did, one right on top of the other, she could not help but link them together in her mind. Katsumi Hosokawa came into her room in the middle of the night, and for the longest time he just stood there inside her bedroom door and held her. It was as if he had returned from something no one is meant to survive. A plane crash, a ship lost at sea, and he could imagine nothing more than this, her in his arms. There was nothing they could say to one another, but Roxanne was far beyond thinking that speaking the same language was the only way to communicate with people. Besides, what was there to say, really? He knew her. She leaned against him, her arms around his neck, his hands flat against her back. Sometimes she nodded or he rocked her back and forth. From the way he was breathing, she thought he might be crying, and she understood that too. She cried herself. Cried for the relief that came in being with him in that dark room. The relief that came from loving someone and from being loved. They would have stood there all night. He would have left without ever asking for anything else if she hadn't reached behind her at some point and taken one of his hands, led him there to her bed. There were so many ways to talk. He kissed her as she was leaning back, the curtains closed, the room completely dark. In the morning, she woke up for a minute, stretched, rolled over and went back to sleep. She didn't know how long she slept, but then she heard singing, and for the second time she was struck by the thought that she wasn't alone. It wasn't that she was in love with Cesar, but she was in love with his singing. It was like this. Every night, Mr. Hosokawa came back to her bedroom, and every morning, Cesar waited to practice. If there was something else to want, she forgot what it might be. "Breathe," she said, "like this." Roxanne filled up her lungs, took in more air, and then some more, and then held it. It didn't matter that he didn't understand the words she used. She stepped behind him and put her hand flat on his diaphragm. What she was saying was clear. She pushed all of the breath from his body and then filled him up again. She sang a line of Tosti, moving her hand back and forth like a metronome, and he sang it back to her. He was not a conservatory student who thought that to please was to be careful. He did not have a lifetime of mediocre instruction to overcome. He was not afraid. He was a boy, full of a boy's bravado, and when the line came back, it was loud and passionate. He sang every line, every scale, as if the singing would save his life. He was settling into his own voice now, and it was a voice that amazed her. It would have lived and died in a jungle, this voice, if she hadn't come along to rescue it. It was a fine time, except for the fact that Messner didn't linger anymore. He was thinner, his clothes hung from his shoulders as if they were sitting alone on a wire coat hanger. He only dropped things off and then was in a hurry to get away.
Cesar had his lesson in the morning, and no matter how hard he begged them to go outside, everyone sat down and listened. He was improving so quickly, even the other boys knew that what they were seeing was more interesting than television. He didn't sound a thing like Roxanne anymore. He was finding his own depth. Every morning he unfolded his voice before them like a rare jeweled fan. The more you listened, the more intricate it became. The crowd assembled in the living room could always count on the fact that he would be even better than he had been the day before. That was what was so astonishing about it. He had yet to show the slightest hint of finding the edges of what he was capable of. He sang with hypnotic passion, and then with passionate lust. How impossible it seemed, so much voice pouring out of such an average boy. His arms still hung useless at his sides. When Cesar released his final note, they were raucous, stamping their feet and whistling. "Hail Cesar," they called, hostage and terrorist alike. He was their boy. There was not a man or woman there who did not acclaim his greatness. Thibault leaned over and whispered in the vice president's ear, "One must wonder how our diva is taking this." "With a brave face, no doubt," Rubén whispered back, and then he put two fingers in his mouth and blew a long, high whistle. Cesar took a few nervous bows, and when he was through, the crowd began to call for Roxanne. "Sing, sing," they demanded. She shook her head several times, but they did not accept this. It only made them call out more. When she finally stood, she was laughing, because who did not feel the joy in such music? She raised her hands to try and silence them. "Only one," she said. "I can't compete with this." She leaned over and whispered in Cato's ear, and he nodded. What was she whispering? They did not speak the same language. Cato had transcribed the music from Il Barbiere di Siviglia for the piano, and his fingers sprang high off the keys, as if they were scorching to the touch. There was a time when she had missed the orchestra, the sweet weight of so many violins in front of her. But she never thought about it now. She stepped into the music as if it was a cool stream on a hot day, and began Una voce poco fa. The music sounded exactly right to her now, and she thought this was the way Rossini had always intended it to be. Despite what anyone might whisper, she could certainly compete, and she could win. Her singing was a meringue, and when she trilled past the highest notes, she put her hands on her hips and rocked them back and forth, smiling wickedly at the audience. She was an actress, too. She must teach that part to Cesar. 1,000 wayward tricks and subtle wiles I'd play before they should guide my will. They cheered for her. Oh, how they loved those ridiculously high notes, the impossible acrobatics that she tossed off as if they were nothing at all. At the end, she made them dizzy. And then she threw up her hands and said, "Outside, all of you." And even though they didn't know what she was saying, they followed her command and went out into the sunlight. Mr. Hosokawa laughed and kissed her cheek. Who could believe such a woman existed? He went to the kitchen to make her a cup of tea, and Cesar sat beside her on the piano bench, hoping that his lesson might be extended now that everyone was gone. The rest went outside to play soccer or sit in the grass and watch the soccer game. Rubén had been able to petition a spade and a small hand rake from the gardener's shed, which was locked, and he turned over the soil in the flower beds, which he had meticulously cleared of weeds and grass. Ishmael skipped the game in order to help him. He didn't mind, he never liked to play. Rubén gave him a silver serving spoon with which to dig. "My father had a wonderful way with plants," Rubén told him. "All he had to do was say a few kind words to the ground, and here they would come. He had meant to be a farmer like his father, but the drought caught them all." Rubén shrugged and slipped his spade into the hard soil, turned it over.
"He would be proud of us now," Ishmael said.
The boys who were on guard climbed into the ivy banks at the edge of the yard, leaned their guns against the stucco wall, and joined the game. The runners gave up their running to play. Una voce poco fa still bounced around in their heads, and even though they could not hum it, they chased the ball to the rhythm of the song. Beatrice had gotten the ball away from Simon Thibault and kicked it over to Jesus, who had a clear shot to take it past two chairs that were set up as the goal, and the generals yelled to him, "Now, now!" The light was cut to lace by the trees that had grown so thick with leaves in the last few months, but still the light was everywhere. It was early, hours before lunch. Cato left the piano and came outside to sit in the grass in the sun beside Gen. So the only sound was the kick of the ball, the calling of names,
Gilbert, Francisco, Paco, as they ran. When Roxanne Koss screamed, it was because she saw a man she didn't recognize walking quickly into the room. She wasn't startled by his uniform or by his gun, she was used to those, but the way he came toward them was terrifying. He walked like no wall could stop him. Whatever he meant to do, his mind was made up, and nothing she could say or sing would ever make a difference. Cesar jumped up from the piano bench where he had been sitting, and before he had gotten anywhere close to the door, he was shot. He fell straight forward, not putting out his hands to save himself, not calling for anyone to help. Roxanne crouched beneath the piano, her voice sounding out the alarm. She crawled toward the boy who she was sure was meant to be the greatest singer of his time, and covered his body with her own, lest something else should happen to him. She could feel his warm blood soaking her shirt, wetting her skin. She took his head in her hands and kissed his cheeks. At the sound of the shot, it seemed the man with the gun divided, first into two and then four, eight, 16, 32, 64. With every loud pop, more came, and they spread through the house and jumped through the windows, poured through the doors into the garden. No one could see where they had come from, only that they were everywhere. Their boots seemed to kick the house apart, to open up every entrance. They covered the playing field while the ball was still rolling away from the game. The guns fired over and over, and it was impossible to say if the ones who were dropping were trying to protect themselves or if they had been hit. It was an instant, and in that instant, everything that had been known about the world was forgotten and relearned. The men were shouting something, but with the rushing of blood in his ears, the sickening spin of adrenaline, the deafness left over from the gunfire, not even Gen could understand them. He saw General Benjamin look back towards the wall, possibly gauging its height, and then with a shot Benjamin was down, the bullet catching him squarely in the side of his head. In one shot he lost both his life and the life of his brother Luis, who would soon be taken from prison and executed for conspiracy. General Alfredo had already fallen. Humberto, Ignacio, Guadalupe, dead. Then Lothar Falcon put his hands up and Father Arguedas put his hands up. Bernardo and Sergio and Beatrice put their hands up.
Ort und Stelle bleiben,
Lothar said. Stay put. But where was the translator? German was useless to him now. General Hector started to put up his hands, but he was shot before they had passed his chest. The strangers cut the group apart as if they knew every member intimately. There was not a second's hesitation as to who was to be pulled away, handed down the line of men towards the back of the house where the sounds of guns being fired reported back to them without any pause. There were not that many people in the house, even if they meant to shoot every one of them 100 times. They could not have fired so many shots. Renato was off his feet, twisting and screaming like a wild animal as he was pulled away by 2 men, each holding one of his arms. Father Arguedas rushed forward to help the boy, and then just as quickly he was hit. He thought he had been shot, a bullet bearing into the back of his neck, and in that moment he remembered his God. But when he was on the grass, he knew he was wrong. He was very much alive. He opened his eyes and found himself looking at Ishmael, his friend. Not 2 minutes dead. The vice president was crying into the boy's neck, his eyes pressed closed, his mouth stretched open wide. He was holding his child's lovely head in his hands. In Ishmael's hands was the spoon with which he had been digging. Beatrice held her hands up straight above her head, and the sun hit the crystal of Gen's watch and threw a perfect circle of light against the wall. All around her were the people she knew. There was General Hector lying on his side, his glasses gone, his shirt a soggy mess. There was Gilbert, who once she had kissed out of boredom. He was flat on his back, his arms stretched out to the sides as if he meant to fly. Then there was someone else. But that was awful. She couldn't tell who it was. She felt afraid of them now, the people she knew. She had more in common with the strangers who were shooting because she and they were all alive. She would keep her arms the straightest of them all. That was the difference. She would do exactly what she was told, and she would be spared. She closed her eyes and looked for her dark pile of sins, hoping she could release a few more on her own without the help of the priest, thinking that fewer sins would give her a lightness that these new men would recognize. But the sins were gone.
She looked and looked behind the darkness of her eyelids, but there was not a single sin left, and she was amazed. She heard Oscar Mendoza calling her name.
Beatriz! Beatriz!
And she opened her eyes. He was coming towards her, his arms stretched out. He was running towards her like a lover, and she smiled at him. Then she heard another gunshot, but this time it knocked her off her feet. A pain exploded up high in her chest and spit her out of this terrible world. Gen saw Beatriz fall and called for Carmen. Where was Carmen? He did not know if she was outside. He could not see her anywhere. No one was more clever than Carmen. No one was more likely to escape, unless she did something stupid. What if she had some idea of saving him?
She is my wife! She is my wife!
He cried into the bedlam, because that was the only plan he had ever devised, even though he had never asked her to marry him or asked the priest to bless them. She was his wife in every way that mattered, and that would save her. But nothing could save her. Carmen was already dead. Killed right at the start. She had been in the kitchen putting the dishes back into the china closet when Mr. Hosokawa came in to make the tea. He bowed to her, which always made her smile, shyly. He had not reached the kettle when they heard Roxanne Koss. Not a song, but a scream, and then a long wolf-like howl. Together they turned towards the door, Mr. Hosokawa and Carmen. They ran together down the hallway, Carmen younger, faster, in front of him. They were through the dining room when they heard the shot that brought down Cesar. They stepped into the living room just as a man with a gun turned to face them, just as Roxanne took the body of her student in her arms. Time, so long suspended, now came back with such force that it overlapped and everything happened at once. Roxanne saw them as the man with the gun saw them. Carmen saw Cesar and Mr. Hosokawa saw Carmen, and he scooped her from the space in front of him. The force of his arm hitting the side of her waist like a blow. He was in front of her the instant she was being thrown behind him, the instant the man who saw her standing in front, separate from Mr. Hosokawa, fired his gun. From 6 feet away, there would have been no missing her, except for the confusion, the firing of guns, the frenzy of voices, the man who was on the list to save stepping in front of her. One shot fixed them together, in a pairing no one had considered before. Carmen and Mr. Hosokawa, her head just to the left of his, as if she was looking over his shoulder. Epilogue. When the ceremony was over, the wedding party walked out into the late afternoon sun. Edith Thibault kissed the bride and groom and then kissed her own husband for good measure. There was a brightness in her that the other three lacked. She still believed she was lucky. She had been the one who insisted that she and Simone come to Lucca for the day to be witnesses for Gen and Roxanne. It was only right to wish them well. I thought it was beautiful, she said in French. The four of them spoke French. Thibault held his wife's arm as if he was dizzy. It would have been nice if someone had thought to fly Father Arguedas up to perform the ceremony, but no one had thought of it, and now the thing was done. The French government fully expected Thibault would resume his post after an adequate period of rest. But when the Thibaults left the house for Paris, they took all of their personal belongings with them. Simon and Edith would never set foot in that godforsaken country again. Quel bled, they said now. It was early May, and the tourist season had not yet begun in Lucca. The old stone streets would soon be packed solid with college students holding guidebooks, but for now it was completely empty. It felt like their own private city, which was exactly what the bride wanted, a very quiet wedding in the birthplace of Giacomo Puccini. A breeze came up, and she held down her hat with her hand. I'm happy, Roxanne said, and then she looked at Gen and said it again. He kissed her. The restaurants won't be open yet, Edith said. She scanned the square with one hand shading her eyes. It was like an ancient, abandoned city, something brought up clean from an archaeological dig. No part of Paris was ever like this. Go and see if there's a bar somewhere, will you? We should have a glass of wine to toast. Roxanne and I can wait here. These streets weren't meant for heels. Thibault felt a small flush of panic, but just as quickly he got hold of it. The square was too open, too quiet. He had felt better inside the church. A drink, absolutely. He kissed her once near her eye and then kissed her again on the lips. It was a wedding day, after all, a wedding day in Italy. You don't mind waiting?
Gen asked Roxanne. She smiled at him. Married women don't mind waiting.
Edith Thibault took her hand and admired the bright new ring. They minded terribly, but they would still like a glass of wine.
The two women sat down on the edge of a fountain, Roxanne with a bouquet of flowers in her lap, and watched as the men wandered off down one of the narrow, identical streets. When they turned out of sight, Edith thought she had made a mistake. She and Roxanne should have taken off their shoes and gone along. Gen and Thibault crossed two piazzas before either of them said anything, and their silence made the clap of their heels echo up the high walls.
"So you live in Milan?" Thibault said.
"It's a beautiful city."
"And your work?"
Because Gen's work had been Mr. Hosokawa.
"I mostly translate books now. It leaves my schedule more flexible. I like to go to rehearsals with Roxanne."
"Yes, of course,"
Thibault said absently and pushed his hands deep into his pockets as they walked.
"I miss hearing her sing. You should come visit."
A boy on a bright red moped sped past, and then two men with dachshunds came out of a bakery and walked towards them. The city wasn't deserted after all.
"Will you miss Japan?"
Gen shook his head. "It's better for her here. Better for me too, I'm sure. All opera singers should live in Italy." He pointed to the building on the corner.
"There's a bar that's open."
Thibault stopped. He would have missed it. He hadn't been paying attention.
"Good. Then we've done our job. Let's go back for our wives."
But Gen didn't turn. He stared at the bar for a long time as if it were a place he had once lived, years before. Thibault asked him if something was wrong. He froze up like that from time to time himself.
"I wanted to ask you," Gen said, but it took him another minute to find the words. "Carmen and Beatrice were never mentioned in the papers. Everything I've read says there were 59 men and one woman.
Is that the way they reported it in France?" Thibault said there had been no mention of the girls. Gen nodded.
"I suppose it makes a better story that way. 59 and 1.
He wore a white rose boutonniere on his wedding suit. Edith had brought it for him in a cardboard box along with the bouquet of white roses for Roxanne to carry. She had pinned the flower on his lapel herself.
"I've called the papers and asked them to publish a correction, but no one is interested. It's almost as if they never existed." "Nothing you read in the papers is true," Thibault said.
He was thinking about the first time they had to cook dinner, all those chickens, and the girls and Ishmael coming in with the knives. Still, Gen wouldn't look at him. He talked as if he were telling the story to the bar.
"I called Rubain. Did I tell you that? I called to tell him about the wedding. He said that he thought we should wait, that we would be wrong to rush into anything. He was very kind about it, you know how Rubén would be. But we didn't want to wait. I love Roxanne."
"No," Thibault said, "you did the right thing. Getting married was the best thing that ever happened to me."
Though now he was wondering about Carmen. Why had he never thought of it before? He could plainly remember them together, time after time, standing at the back of the room whispering. The way her face brightened when she turned it again. Thibault did not wish to see her face again.
"When I hear Roxanne sing, I am still able to think well of the world," Gen said. "This is a world in which someone could have written such music. A world in which she can still sing that music with so much compassion. That's proof of something, isn't it? I don't think I would last a day without that now."
Even when Thibault closed his eyes and rubbed them with his thumb and forefinger, he could still see Carmen. Her hair in a braid on the back of her slender neck. She is laughing.
"She is a beautiful girl," he said.
They had found the bar. He needed to get back to Edith now. He looped his arm around his friend's shoulder and guided him back in the direction of the Piazza San Martino. He felt himself growing breathless, and he had to concentrate on the muscles in his legs to keep from running. He was sure that Gen and Roxanne had married for love. The love of each other, and the love of all the people they remembered. When they turned the corner, the street opened into the bright square, and there the wives were, still sitting on the edge of the fountain. They were looking in the direction of the cathedral, but then Edith turned, and when she saw him, the joy in her face. They stood up and walked towards the two men, Edith with her dark hair shining, Roxanne still in her hat. Either one of them could have been the bride. Thibault was sure there had never been such beautiful women, and the beautiful women came to them and held out their arms. My love and gratitude to my editor, Robert Jones. This concludes the reading of Bel Canto by Anne Patchett. Copyright 2001 by Anne Patchett. This unabridged recording of the reading of Bel Canto was published by arrangement with HarperCollins Publisher and was produced in 2001 by Blackstone Audiobooks Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audiobooks. This book was read by Anna Fields. If you would like to obtain a complete printed catalog of our titles or our monthly update telling you about new releases and our new collection of books on CD, write Blackstone Audiobooks, P.O. Box 969, Ashland, Oregon, 97520, or call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. You may also obtain the same information from our award-winning website. Our address, all one word, is www.blackstoneaudio.com. Thank you.